Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby, and joining me is Claire White.
Hi.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and stories. Today we're talking about The Man in the High Castle, the Amazon original show, which is based off of the Philip K. Dick book of the same name, Man in the High Castle. And while there's no sexy robots in The Man in the High Castle, Philip K. Dick was one of the first pioneers of the sexy robot. Just wanted to make sure you guys knew that.
It's a big day for our podcast.
It's a big day. We haven't hit dragons yet, but we're hitting sexy robots.
kind of.
Yeah. So Claire will be discussing the history of The Man in the High Castle and the alternate history kind of book
genre,
genre. And I'll be hitting the production of the show. So Claire, take it away.
All right. Well, first of all, as Kyle mentioned, Man in the High Castle is alternate history, which is a genre of fiction in which the author speculates on how the course of history might have been altered if a particular historical event had a different outcome. So that basically, in Man in the High Castle, this is speculating what if the Axis powers had won World War II.
Not good things, probably.
Probably. Now, this is not to be confused with counterfactual history, and this is where professors and academics use it to research what might have happened. They're doing it from a more historical perspective.
Okay, it's for
academic research.
Yeah.
Now, alternate history is a subgenre of historical fiction, and it can be merged with science fiction. I had originally thought it was science fiction, but it makes more sense, actually, because sometimes there's no weird magic space stuff happening or
Man in the High Castle definitely had that science fiction.
A little bit of it, but it doesn't have to.
Okay.
And this is what it normally contains. The general consensus is if it's alternate history, normally this is what happens. There's a point of divergence from history as we know it.
Okay.
A change that would alter history as we know it, and then it's an examination of that change. So if you see those three things, you're reading alternate history. And there's different ways that history can be changed. Someone can go back in time and change history. There can also be just something happened. Say Churchill died and then the Allies just couldn't rally without Churchill, so the Axis powers won World War II.
So is Back to the Future?
That's
alternate history.
Yeah.
When they go to the 1980s where Biff controls...
Where Biff is the man.
Because they went back in time.
Man.
Yeah, where he's the man. He's like Donald Trump, sort of.
Yeah, with more power.
With more power. That's...
Yeah, so that's alternate history. Also, and this confuses me, and I'm not going to lie, I'm sure there's other people listening or around you who can explain this a lot better, but basically there can be multiple timelines that branch off from each other, or there's alternate universes that have alternate endings.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of ways there can be alternate history.
You see that at the end of Man in the High Castle. I don't want to spoil the end, but it doesn't quite end the way you think it would end.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Yeah.
So I'm also going to talk about a brief history of alternate history.
Nice.
My favorite title ever. And the first instance of alternate history being written was by a man named Titus Livius, or better known as the Roman historian Livy.
Livy was writing alternate history?
Livy certainly was.
That's
and he
so cool.
wrote, and I might butcher this, Ab Urbe Condita Libri, and this is where he contemplates what might have happened if Alexander the Great had gone west instead of east, and would the Romans been able to stand up to Alexander the Great?
I wouldn't think so.
Livy said yes. Livy says we definitely would have won. Probably would have won.
Livy was full of piss and vinegar as a Roman.
So the next instance of alternate history was in 1490, and this is right after the Christians lost Constantinople to the Turks, and it was a huge blow to Christianity because it was one of their major cities.
People were pretty bummed in Europe.
People were really bummed. Morale was low.
Yeah.
And this Spanish knight named Jeannot Motorel, which I love saying, wrote Tirant le Blanche, where a knight called Tirant the White from Brittany becomes a mega duke in the Byzantine Empire, and he manages to fight off the Ottoman army of Mehmet II, and he even manages to chase the Turks further into Turkey. So this is like, if only this could have happened, alternate history.
We could have taken Constantinople, kind of wish fulfillment fantasy.
Yeah. And this, another kind of wish fulfillment fantasy is the next major work of alternate history. It was actually the first one published for a large audience, and this was by Louis Joffre, who is a French writer, and he wrote The History of the Universal Monarchy, Napoleon and the Conquest of the World. Can you guess what that's about?
I assume it has something to do with Napoleon not losing in Russia
no.
in winter.
No, it's about Napoleon taking Russia, and then in 1814 they're able to take England.
Oh, wow. That's a cool topic for alternate history, too. I feel like it's oftentimes
it's
World War II.
It's a popular topic for alternate history, yeah. I'll get into that later. The first English work of alternate history was in 1845, and it was actually by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Oh, Scarlet Letter, right?
Yes, he's one of the major early American writers, and it's called Pea's Correspondence, and he deals with two parallel realities, where Pea, who's called Pea to protect his name, is a madman and considered a madman by his family because he perceives an alternate 1845 where people who are dead are alive, like Lord Byron and Lord Shelby.
Oh, okay.
And people who are alive, like Charles Dickens, are dead, and he's able to talk to these people in this alternate reality.
Okay. Sounds very arty.
Yeah. Nathaniel Hawthorne. Yeah, you know.
If only I could talk to Byron.
The first alternate history novel written in English was actually by the American writer Costello Holford. It was written in 1895, and it was called Aristophia, A Romance History of the New World. And this is where the earliest settlers in Virginia find a reef made of gold, and they use it to build this utopian society in North America.
It's funny that, like, all these alternate history books you've mentioned have been kind of wish fulfillment, like a French guy being like, if only Napoleon could have taken over the world,
yeah,
or a Spanish guy.
That's how
being,
it started out. Or, you know, the Spanish guy, if only the Christians had won.
Had won in Turkey, yeah.
Yes. Well, it starts to get darker, don't worry. Starting, actually, in 1923, H.G. Wells wrote Men Like Gods, and this is where some Englishmen, and this is actually including a guy who was based on Churchill, kind of a satiric
very nice
take
very
on
nice.
It, and are transferred by accident with a time machine to an alternate universe to a very pacifistic, utopian Great Britain. And so they try to seize power, and then the utopians point ray guns at them and send them to another universe.
What year was this made?
1923.
That's interesting because I think a lot of people forget that Churchill was still a big name in England. He's kind of seen as a warmonger.
He was in World War One. He was a huge deal. Well, actually, speaking of Churchill, in 1931, the British historian Sir John Squire collected a series of essays from leading scholars and leading public figures, and he made an anthology called If It Had Happened Otherwise. And it contained essays called If the Moors in Spain Had Won. And actually, Mr. Churchill wrote for it, and he wrote, If Lee Had Not Won the Battle of Gettysburg. And that's the title. And it was written from the point of view of a historian in a world where the Confederacy had won.
Oh,
and the
cool.
Characters wondering what would have happened if the North had been victorious.
That's really interesting.
Go Churchill.
Yeah, Churchill. Nice, man. Was there a H.G. Wells-esque character in his book that he got zapped into another dimension?
Not that I heard of, but maybe give it back to the man. In 1939, one of the most influential books of alternate history that has actually influenced a lot of later alternate history writers was written. It's called Lest Darkness Fall by L. Sprague de Camp. And in this book, an American archaeologist is transported back to 6th century Rome, and he tries to stop the Dark Ages.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's a little daunting of a task, I feel like.
Yeah, but if you know the tech, he's an archaeologist, so he knows the technology.
Stop the Dark Ages.
Right. So those are the early influential works. In the 1960s, it starts, more works are coming out. That's when Man in the High Castle came out.
Yeah, Man in the High Castle came out in 1962.
And then especially in the late 80s, 90s is when alternate history becomes really popular. It actually has its own award called the Sideways Award. It's named after the 1933 short story Sideways in Time by Murray Leinster, which is another alternate history story. And that was established in 1995, and it's given out every year to recognize the best alternate history stories of the year.
Very cool.
So alternate history is really a thing.
Yeah.
Some of the most popular topics in alternate history that I wanted to talk about is, of course, what if the Axis powers had won?
Yeah, World War II, this is true.
What if the South had won the Civil War is another really popular. Napoleon beating the Russians is still, to this day, a very popular topic. What if the Roman Empire had never fallen? What if the Aztecs had defeated Cortez?
Oh, cool.
What would have happened? We don't know.
I always wanted to write a story about if it took Europe much longer to get to America, and by the time they got there, the Aztecs were technologically advanced.
You should do it. Maybe you can get a Sideways Award.
Maybe. Yeah. Is Harry Turtledove at all in there? He's one guy I read a lot.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely one. He's actually going on to some of the most popular alternate history books written recently. Harry Turtledove is probably the most popular alternate history writer, if not the most prolific. He was part of the boom in the 80s and 90s. Ruled Britannia and How Few Remain are some of his biggest ones. I know you've read some of his stuff.
Yeah, I had a big Harry Turtledove phase when I was 19 or 20. I really got into his alternate history about if the South had won the Civil War.
I would really like to read some of his stuff. When you're doing all this research, it's like, oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. This is cool. I wonder where this could go. It's pretty neat.
It's very cool. All these books that I'm going to mention, I'm like, oh, I should be reading these. Your Rice and Salt by Kim Stanley Robinson is what if the Black Death had killed 99% of Europe's population?
Oh,
very interesting.
Yeah.
The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, who's one of the more prominent contemporary American authors right now. And it's where Roosevelt loses re-elections and Charles Lindbergh is re-elected. And
Lindbergh was a fascist, too.
Yeah, and how the relationship with Germany and all of that.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and you can see how huge authors like Philip Roth are writing alternate history now, and it's become a much bigger deal and very accepted as opposed to this weird little sci genre that Philip K. Dick was writing in.
Yeah, and that's, you know what, that's not even, most of the books he wrote were sci-fi anyway. This was kind of like the one dalliance not super
but
sci-fi.
It was way more rare back then.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, alternate history comes up in all kinds of other media. We were talking about movies. There's Back to the Future, Inglourious Basterds, Django
Unchained. Yeah. You see it in video games, too. Like, the Resistance video games are kind of alternate history.
Totally. Civ 5, which I know is one of our favorite video games.
We love Civ 5.
Where there's, you know, you get to kind of create your own history. Metal Gear Solid, which is a video game. And in TV shows, it's not as common. In fact, I actually think Man in a High Castle is the first instance of the TV show focusing on alternate history. Shows like Twilight Zone and Star Trek have played with it in certain episodes.
Yeah.
But, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I couldn't find an instance of a TV show just dealing with...
With an alternate history. Instead of like, I mean, you could say maybe like a comic book, like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or it's like a... But that's an alternate world. It's
alternate world.
Alternate history.
Yeah, well, because
like
I was also...
Captain America was around in World War II.
Right. Well, Watchmen, which isn't a TV show, but Watchmen is alternate history for this, like,
for the
superhero
universe. Yeah, the
superhero
comic kind of universe.
Yeah,
genre.
X-Men, Days of Future Past.
Yeah, stuff like that.
And that's my history of alternate history.
Pretty cool, history of alternate history.
Thanks, Kyle.
I love it. Some of those books sound really interesting, like The Year of Rice and Salt.
I know.
I'm super curious about it. Never heard of that before.
Yeah, my ever-growing pile of books that I need to read.
The list of books to read just gets bigger and bigger.
Yes. Well, I would like to hear more about production.
Well, I will tell you more about production.
Oh, wow.
I think the production of Man in the High Castle can really be traced all the way back to 1982.
Whoa.
I know, it's quite old.
It's been going on for that long?
Sort of. In 1982, Blade Runner came out. And Blade Runner was a movie directed by Ridley Scott that got tons of accolades. People loved it.
But
Blade Runner is a movie based on a book by Philip K. Dick.
Mm.
And the book that it was based off of is a book called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Now, Ridley Scott asked Philip K. Dick to help him with this, help him with the movie. And Ridley Scott was showing Philip K. Dick some of the artwork for Blade Runner. And Philip K. Dick was like, huh, this looks more like another book I wrote called Man in the High Castle, not so much like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. And Ridley Scott said, oh, I've never read Man in the High Castle. And Philip K. Dick was like, well, you should. It's a good one. It's one of his... It was largely considered his best book. I don't think it's his best book, but it kind of put him on the map as a writer. So Ridley Scott read Man in the High Castle and loved it and thought, I need to do a movie or a TV show or something with this book.
And this was in 19...
This is in 1982.
So it only took 30?
It only took about 30 years, yeah. Claire. So, yeah, so, you know, all through the 80s and 90s, Ridley Scott's making tons of other movies. Like, he made Gladiator, Kingdom of Heaven.
He's been busy.
Thelma and Louise. He's been pretty busy. So fast forward to 2010, and Ridley Scott's approaching BBC and is asking them to, you know, help him with this show of Man in the High Castle, the four-part series. And at first, BBC was really into the idea, and they were, like, kind of getting the ball rolling, and it was Ridley Scott's production company, Scott Free, along with Philip K. Dick's production company that's run by his children, because he passed away, I think, in 1982, before Blade Runner was even out.
Before he made any money, right?
Before he passed away before he made any money for Philip K. Dick. But his kids benefited a lot.
Right. He's a great artist. It makes him a great artist.
Yeah, it does. It does. So his kids have a production company based on Philip K. Dick books, like going to movies and TV, and it's called Electric Shepherd Productions. And so Scott Free Production Company and Electric Shepherd were working with BBC to make this four-part series. And BBC was down with it until, I guess, they got more of a look at the source material, and they were afraid that depicting a world run by Nazis was just a little too depressing and too dark, and they passed. They didn't want to do it. They kind of dropped it.
Okay.
Which is sad, but, you know, you kind of get it. Like, no one wants to see a Nazi-run America. Or a Nazi-run
Europe. Or do they?
Or do they, apparently, because the show did pretty well. So after BBC dropped it, it was picked up by Sci-Fi, the science fiction movie channel, movies, shows, and they produced their own material. And they were going to do a four-part series of Man in the High Castle.
This sounds like it would be right up their alley.
It totally would be. And this is where Frank Spotnitz enters the picture. Now, Frank Spotnitz was one of the head writers for The X-Files, and he had a lot of, like, writer street cred for being a really huge part of The X-Files mythos and a lot of their standalone episodes. Like, he didn't create The X-Files, but he was a big, big part.
A huge influencer.
Yeah, on The X-Files and making that show. So he was pretty beloved amongst the kind of sci-fi nerd community, and he also happens to be a huge fan of Philip K. Dick. He said he read The Man in the High Castle in college and it changed his life, and he loved the book. He thought it was so cool, and he would love to be a part of this project. Now, when Spotnitz came on, he kind of took over writing and producing. His production company also jumped on to help produce this show, and his production company is called Big Light Productions. And Spotnitz took over the show, wrote up the treatment, kind of became the director, the main driving force in getting this show on the air somehow. And they wrote it was once again going to be a four-part series on Sci-Fi. And once again, Sci-Fi balked at the idea because they didn't want to do this depressing future Nazi land.
I can see how it would be intimidating.
Yeah, because it could go really, really wrong.
Yeah, there's so many people you can offend in just one quick swipe.
Yeah, yeah. So Sci-Fi dropped the idea, but enter here, Amazon.com. So in 2014, Amazon picked up Man in the High Castle with Spotnitz and said, "All right, we'll give you a pilot. You produce a pilot for us, and we'll see what people think of it." And this brings me to Amazon's their process for selecting shows,
which is really interesting.
It's cool, yeah.
It's kind of the future.
It's the future. So Amazon will pick certain people to make pilots of whatever show they want. Those pilots will go up onto Amazon, and anyone can watch them. You don't have to be on Amazon Prime. Like, you don't have to be a subscriber. You can just watch these pilots. And they'll look at those pilots and see which pilots were watched the most, and those are made into 10-episode shows.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Super smart.
Democracy.
Yeah. It's also interesting what would gain traction, because maybe something that's really different or really cool.
Yeah.
Would gain traction, but some shows tend to pick up later.
Yeah, this is true.
It's an interesting way to do it.
This is true. Yeah, I think it could backfire in some ways, because I think you could have a really, really good show that just doesn't, it's maybe not as enticing. Man of the High Castle, when they have all this Nazi imagery, I think more people are inclined to be like, oh.
What is that?
What's that?
And it's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, so more people are going to watch it.
Yeah.
At least the initial pilot. So that pilot for Man in the High Castle was released on Amazon on January 15th of 2015. And by February 18th of 2015, it was picked up for a 10-episode season. with Spotnitz as head writer, creator, showrunner. And so the Man in the High Castle pilot was the most watched pilot that Amazon at that time had ever put out. I don't know if that's still the case, but at February 18th, 2015, no one had watched any other Amazon pilot as much as they had watched Man in the High Castle. So obviously, you know, it was going to be picked up for that first season. The production bill for Man in the High Castle was being split three different ways. And I sometimes imagine, like, this is like people at a restaurant trying to split the bill, like, between credit cards and cash. I wonder if it's complicated. But but Ridley Scott's production company, Scott Free, is producing it, along with Frank Spotnitz's Big Light Productions, along with the Philip K. Dick production company, Electric Shepherd.
And this is all under the Amazon banner.
And it's all under the Amazon banner. And the Philip K. Dick production company now consists of Isa Dick Hackett, his daughter, Laura Leslie, his other daughter, and Christopher Dick, his son. So Spotnitz says he has an ending for the show. It's not one of those shows that's just going to be written on and on and on with no end in sight, like Lost or something.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica.
Battlestar Galactica, which I love, but also hate.
It seems to be the consensus.
Yeah, yeah. And so he's got an ending, he knows where it's going, and the second season is slated to come out sometime in this year of 2016. Very exciting.
Very exciting.
So one of the big things I wanted to talk about with the production of the show is something known as the Great Train Kerfuffle.
Known as that?
It's known to me as the Great Train. I made it up right now.
Okay.
It's going to be known from now on as the Great Train Kerfuffle.
It's a great name.
It is. Kerfuffle. It's a good word. Now, November 15th, 2015, Amazon decided for a marketing campaign that they are going to deck out a whole subway train in New York City, the shuttle train that goes from Grand Central to Times Square. And they talked to the MTA, and they're going to deck out the whole train with Man in the High Castle advertisements.
Okay.
How do they do this? They decide it's a great idea to fill the inside of this train with almost Nazi and Imperialist Japan propaganda. There's pictures of the Statue of Liberty with its hand in the air wearing like a Nazi sash with the Nazi Iron Eagle. No swastikas. They weren't putting swastikas on anything, but the Nazi eagle was everywhere. The Japanese Imperial Rising Sun was everywhere. Did you walk into the train?
No, I didn't.
We live
did
in
you?
New York. Yeah, I walked in and oh my God.
I know, in the most, one of the most Jewish cities.
One of the most Jewish cities.
Probably, is it the most Jewish city in the United States?
I don't know this for a fact, but I would safely guess yes, it is. Where there's people here who have probably been affected by the Holocaust directly, even.
Gosh, Grandma. And your Jewish grandma walks in. She just wants to go to Grand Central to have her oysters.
So the MTA, when they were asked about it, they were like, look, it doesn't break any of our guidelines. The MTA says they won't do advertisements for politics, no political advertisements, and no hate speech. And they said that if you think that Amazon, like, this is fine unless you think that Amazon is pushing some sort of fascist agenda, which obviously they're not. However, Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, and Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, not too thrilled on it.
Mm-hmm. So, I remember this.
Yeah, yeah. So they demanded that the advertisements be taken down, and they were supposed to run for a month. They were supposed to run from November 15th of 2015 to December 15th of 2015. But Amazon, after getting called out by the governor and the mayor, they were like, okay, we'll take them down. And they were taken down on November 24th.
So they didn't really put up much of a fuss.
No, they didn't put much of a fuss. And people were upset with them, like, how could you do this? But you know what it did?
Created a lot of publicity.
Created a lot of publicity and a lot of buzz for the show.
So was it a kerfuffle?
Maybe not. Now, I also wanted to mention that, as of right now, Man in the High Castle has a 95% on Rotten Tomatoes, a 77% Metacritic, and 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb scores. So people really like it. It scored really high. And I think this is a good spot to transition into what we thought of Man in the High Castle, the show, after looking at the history of alternate history and the way it was made, the production of it.
I didn't really like it. I don't agree with the Metacritic
and
Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I didn't love the show either. And I'm a diehard Philip K. Dick fan. I've read not all of his books because he's got a ton, but I've read a lot of his books.
Yeah, because I read the book, Man in High Castle, for this podcast. And especially after reading the book, I liked it less.
Yeah.
And not that I'm someone who is a stickler. I guess you can be that way, but I don't need the TV show or the movie to be exactly like the book.
I feel the same way. I try to hold them in different
places. Right. It can be improved, especially in a different medium, by doing different things with it. But I just felt like in this, the way it used the material was really weird.
Yeah.
And I read that they were inspired by Mad Men, and they wanted to make kind of a Mad Men-esque show.
And you can see that with the colors and costumes.
Right, how detailed it is. Yeah. And that the detail on the set is really cool. But I feel like the book is more Mad Men than the TV show is.
Yeah.
Because the book is not exciting.
It's
so
not
much.
An action book. It's no. There's no gunfights.
But this, there's so much action. And
yeah.
It's like they didn't just trust us to observe this time period.
Yeah, they thought, you know, like, we need to make it more compelling and more action-y and bullets flying and stuff. The book is not like that at all.
Right, and I think I would have been more interested in just seeing what life would be like.
Yeah, if they had stuck pretty close to the source material.
Yeah. Also, I feel like it's these things with this high-quality TV that we have where this show is actually taking some of the tropes that we've seen in other great shows and
yeah.
applying them, not because they need to apply them, because I think it seems like they feel that they have to apply them. Like, there's this character called the Marshal, and he's played by Bern Gorman, who I've seen in other stuff. He's in Game of Thrones. He plays the guy, the thief, who takes over Caster's Keep.
Yeah, you know what? He was also in Pacific Rim.
Oh, I haven't seen Pacific Rim.
It's a really good movie, but he was good in that.
Yeah, I think he's a good actor, but he just plays this character that I think we're supposed to be terrified of, but it isn't quite earned. I wasn't scared.
Yeah. You didn't really get where he was coming from or, like, what his deal was. He was just like, man with a gun, who's evil?
Right, and it's really over the top,
yeah.
which does work in certain shows, but it didn't feel right.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to describe it.
Yeah.
What is this guy doing here? He doesn't quite fit into the context of all of this.
Yeah. It's funny because we seem to be in the minority with this, Claire, not really enjoying Man of the High Castle, the show, that much.
I don't know.
I have friends either.
Who like it.
Yeah, I have friends who like it. Our friend Ben really likes it.
Yeah, Ben.
Ben. But one problem I have, and it's not necessarily with Man of the High Castle, but there's a huge divorce between, I feel like, Philip K. Dick books and Philip K. Dick movies. I've read a lot of Philip K. Dick books. He's one of my favorite authors. I discovered him in high school. And he's had a lot of movies made from his stories, his books. And they're normally short stories or little novellas. He didn't write these big, thick books. And all of those, or not all of them, but a lot of those movies, they turn something which is more of like a cerebral, trippy idea into an action flick.
And you don't think it works?
It works sometimes. Like, Total Recall, the film with Arnold Schwarzenegger, came out in the early 90s. Really violent action movie. It's a little, people laugh at it. It's a little cheesy, but I love it. I love that movie.
Okay. So that's an instance of it working.
That's an it works, you know, but it's very different from the book, from the Philip K. Dick story, We Buy Your Memories Wholesale.
Okay.
And Minority Report, other really good movie with Tom Cruise, came out in the early 2000s. Based on a Philip K. Dick story, really action-y. Philip K. Dick story, not so action-y. Cool movie. But then there's, for me, Man in the High Castle. Not an action story made into an action show. Didn't quite
Yeah,
work.
I think if the action had been done better, it might have worked. I actually think they wanted to commit to both.
Yeah, I think
And
they
therefore,
did too.
They didn't focus in a way that they should have. Because I think this could be a really good, trippy show.
Yeah.
It could also be a really cool action show,
yeah.
but they don't go, they try to do both. And it doesn't quite work.
Falls flat for me, yeah.
Yeah, also the amount of torture in this show. Not
yeah.
to It's actually not really a spoiler because it happens really early on.
Yeah.
There's so much torture.
Yeah.
And
it's brutal.
Didn't want to watch it. I'm not a fan of torture in really anything.
Yeah, it seemed a little gratuitous and not needed. Like, we don't need... I didn't need to know that Nazis are bad.
We know. We assume.
I know. One of my other big problems with it was that the I Ching, which is a ancient Chinese divination text that you can still get today, it's something where you'll toss a bunch of sticks in the air, and the way the sticks fall, you interpret that with this divination book, and it gives you a little proverb. And you'll ask it questions, like, you know, if you have a crossroads in your life.
Right.
Will this
podcast be good?
Will this podcast be good? And we'll throw it up in the air, and it'll give a weird cryptic proverb. And the I Ching's a huge part of the book.
It's really cool in the book.
It's really cool. All the characters are using it and at pivotal points in their lives.
Right. It's the Japanese influence in America,
yeah,
basically.
In America.
Also in the book, quick side note, don't even deal with the Nazis in the East Coast. It's actually really only the West Coast where Japan is. And a little bit of the Rockies, which is kind of like a neutral zone.
Yeah. The book is set pretty much primarily in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But with the I Ching, Philip K. Dick actually used the I Ching to write his book.
Yeah, you told me this. It's really cool.
It was super
especially
trippy.
With like how the book ends.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's really cool.
So I thought for sure it'd be a bigger part of the show, and it was sort of mentioned.
I can see how that's hard to put in there,
though. Yeah, yeah. It just, I don't know. It was one thing I was really looking forward to.
One last thing.
Yeah.
Just, this is the book, and this is the show. They are so kind to the Japanese.
Yeah, they love the Japanese.
The Nazis. I mean, the show deals with it a little bit better.
Yeah.
But actually, overall, the Japanese are kind of the compassionate conquerors.
Yeah, the Imperial Japan were compassionate, and they were good to the...
Nazis are burning people, wiping out the continent, exterminating this population of the continent of Africa. That was a hard sentence
for
me.
Yeah, that was a hard sentence.
They're doing that, and the Japanese are pretty good.
Yeah, they let people kind of live as they want, live as they will, which is, if you look at World War II, Imperial Japan...
Don't want to be conquered by them.
Was pretty bad.
Ask the Koreans.
Ask the Koreans. Ask the Filipinos.
Ask the Chinese.
Ask the Chinese.
Manchurians.
The Manchurians. Yeah, so you're right. And I think part of that, I don't know this for a fact, but I think part of that comes from Philip K. Dick being Polish, or Polish-American, rather. And so he's going to look at the Nazis in a much sterner light.
Right. He also lived in San Francisco. Was it you who told me this?
Yeah, he lived in San Francisco.
And he was friends with a lot of Japanese-Americans.
Yeah, so they're going to be a little friendlier than the evil Nazi Germans. So like I said before, though, we are a minority. The show fell flat for me and fell flat for you, but it's beloved. I love the books.
I really recommend reading the book.
I really recommend reading
anything,
the book.
More than anything, I wanted to stand up. I was reading in before I went to bed at night, and a part of me wanted to stand up and applaud Philip K. Dick. It is a really good book.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We love listener feedback, so please leave a comment and feel free to contact us. Our website can be found at dsrapodcast.com. I can be found on Twitter at Klex, K-L-E-X, 303.
I can be found at Along With Claire.
And you can contact our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y, J-R, on Twitter. If you enjoyed this podcast, we would love you to rate and review us on iTunes. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next time.